Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Real Vision Daily Briefing, live without a net, once again with Ed Harrison. Welcome back, Ed.
Yes, thank you, Ash. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well. Ed, we were talking off camera a little bit about oil, about price action, of course, about the Fed meeting coming up later this week. What are you looking at? How are you thinking about these markets right now?
Yeah, I'm thinking about them as pretty slow. I mean, the price action today was relatively weak across different markets because people are basically waiting for the Fed. You know, we digested a lot of data in terms of inflation, first and foremost, but also in terms of jobs, in terms of other things like oil. And people are wanting to see what the Fed's going to say before they make any sort of drastic move. So when you look at the indices, they weren't very changed today. The things that I would note beyond the major indices are three things. One, we got the 10-year up to 149.4. We got WTI up to the highest it's been in 3 years at 71.11. That's where it's trading now. Brent's at 73.04. And then the third thing is I got tons of pings for 52-week highs today. So even though it was sort of a mixed day, a lot of stocks hit a 52-week high today.
Yeah. Ed, you were talking about inflation. I know particularly one of the things that's been on your mind, on my mind, is the raw materials inflation. Obviously, the job picture as we come out of this recession. So set the table for us a little bit, big picture, how you're thinking about those two key parameters as we head into Fed Day.
So I think that there are two or three things. One is the inflation numbers themselves and how, by the way, before I get into this, let me just say, because it just occurred to me, I was about to use the magic word. While we're speaking, every single time that you hear the word substantial progress or the word transitory, those are the two drinking words for today. If you're having some beers or cocktails or whatever. So just as an aside.
That's
so
from Tom. I was about comments. Right.
This is for Tom saying, how many times are we going to hear those words? Just for you, Tom, we're going to say them as much as possible. So, The question in terms of inflation, first and foremost, is it transitory or not? That is, the inflation that we're seeing now, is it going to subside in one way, shape, or form? The second thing that people are talking about is inflation expectations, i.e., based upon the inflation that we have now and into the future, what do people think, what do they believe is going to happen towards the future? And that's going to have an impact on bond yields. And then finally, it's what the Fed is going to do. What's the Fed's reaction function? Has it changed demonstrably? I'll give you an example that the Fed said in the last bull cycle, they said, we're not raising interest rates until we get to 2% and above, because 2% is actually not a ceiling. It's a target. That means that we can let the economy run a little bit hot, a little bit cold. It doesn't make a difference. But lo and behold, they started to raise interest rates even before they got to their 2% target. So the Fed said one thing and they did another. So it's not clear if the Fed has changed its tune and what the Fed will do at the second half of the year if inflation prints are high. So those are the three things that people are thinking about. The transitory or the non-transitory nature of the inflation, the expectations based upon that, and then the Fed's reaction function.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Let me just give a little bit of context, a little bit of color around this phrase, substantial progress, because sometimes, you and I, we love this stuff. Many of our viewers love this stuff, but it gets a little bit like interpreting the pronouncements from the Oracle at Delphi. And the context here, the backstory that TomTom was alluding to, is that San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank President Mary Daly said, and let me see if I can find the quote. Effectively, she said that it's not just the Fed must not just expect substantial progress, they must see substantial progress. So it really is this like this weird gaming of language. And I think if we were trying to like do the breakdown here, the 50,000 foot overview, basically what the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank president is signaling is that there really needs to be very clear data that shows the economy heating up before the Fed is going to act. Basically what they're saying, at least in my interpretation, and I'm very curious to hear yours, Ed, because you watch this much closer than I do. What they're basically saying is, don't expect us to move on rates until we really have to move on rates.
Yeah, I mean, my interpretation, the interesting bit is what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about the zero lower bound. And I look at what you're talking about as a communication strategy. It's sort of a forward guidance. So if we weren't at the zero lower bound, we wouldn't be having the conversations like this that we're having. For instance, let's imagine that, the interest rate, the base rate is at 7%. If the base rate were at 7%, then this Fed official that you're talking about would say that we haven't made substantial progress, so we're going to cut rates to 6% or, over time, and we might even go to 5%. So when they say that we're not going to raise interest rates, we're going to keep on doing quantitative easing, large-scale asset purchases, what they're basically telling you is that we're not impotent. We haven't run out of bullets. There are things that we can do in order to impact the economy. But really, what you should be thinking is actually they've run out of bullets, that they can no longer use interest rate policy. So they're using this forward guidance policy. They're completely dependent on forward guidance.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You sort of say, like, when someone says, we haven't run out of bullets yet, is the implication maybe they're running out of bullets. It's kind of like, if a bank comes out with a statement that says, we're not having problems with short-term liquidity. That's exactly the thing that you worry about.
Exactly. So I think that what's telling here is that the Fed is trying to, make it so that, like the wizard in the Wizard of Oz, that, people think that there's some magic. It's not just hocus pocus, it's real magic. But really, you do have to wonder how much oomph the Fed can give to the economy. So, the real question is going forward with inflation, even though they say that they're going to stay the course, is whether or not they move in the opposite direction. Just to reiterate, I mean, they should be, based upon the language that Fed officials are using, reducing interest rates right now. The real question that other people are saying is when you look at the data, the inflation data, in the past, the Fed would be moving in the opposite direction. So when do they make that abrupt shift from moving down to moving up?
Yeah. The other thing that you said that was really interesting that I wanted to come back to was it's a target, not a floor. It reminds me of Goodhart's law. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that statement.
So there was the whole debate in the previous decade about whether or not the Fed was too hawkish. And the debate stemmed around this 2% inflation target. And a lot of people were saying, really the Fed's paradigm is that we're never going to allow inflation to go over 2%. As soon as it hits 2% and then we see it at 2.1%, 2.2%, we're going to step on the brakes. We're going to raise interest rates by 0.25% over and over again until it goes back down below 2%. So effectively, 2% would have been a ceiling under that particular regime. But the Fed was trying to convince people that, no, it's not a ceiling. Actually, it's a target, which means that in times when inflation is below 2%, we're fine with that as long as there are other times when it's above 2%, and it all averages out over the longer term. This 2% is sort of a long-term target that we have, and we're going to fluctuate around that number. When push came to shove, however, the Fed started raising interest rates before it met its target, which meant effectively the 2% number was a ceiling.
Yeah, and a whole lot of what we're doing right now, and I think what needs to be done, is parsing all of this Delphic language around Fed speak. Another way of saying that target, not a ceiling, is that the asymmetric framing, right? When you hear Fed officials or commentators who watch Fed officials talking about how there's going to be asymmetric targeting, meaning precisely what you just said. If the long-term rate is on average 2% and it's been substantially below the 2% target for a long period of time, the flip side is asymmetric. It runs hot to the upside in order to attain a balanced level. And this is just, by the way, we're not endorsing either of these positions. We're just trying to describe what the thinking is, what the language means, and why there's so much, frankly, opacity around trying to understand it.
And, you know, again, the reason that this exists, the reason that there is this language and, we're parsing these things is because we've hit the zero lower bound. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, the reason that the Fed went to liftoff before it hit the 2% target was because they wanted to have the ability to cut rates when the economy went into the opposite direction. It's somewhat perverse, but, you know, raise the interest rate level as high as you can before the economy stalls without causing the economy to stall, so that when it does stall, you are able to cut rates, because cutting rates is preferable to, any sort of jawboning, which is what the Fed's doing now.
Yeah. And also the flip side of that, the balance sheet expansion.
Exactly. So I think that's where we are, you know, in terms of the Fed. I think that it's just going to be interesting to see what they say. Obviously, they're going to probably go the course. They're going to continue. What I'm interested to see is the mix between Treasury securities and MBS, what they say about that mix. Because at present, we're talking $80 billion of QE in terms of Treasury securities, $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities, MBS. And we know that the mortgage market had been red hot. It's cooled off somewhat recently. Are they thinking about changing that mix down the line, or are they just going to continue with that same mix? It might be interesting if they make any sort of hint that if they were to reduce accommodation, the first thing they would do is change the mix of quantitative easing before they actually reduce the level.
Explain, if you would, the significance of that balance between USTs and MBS.
So in the great financial crisis, MBS, that was the locus of problems. And so the Fed, when they started quantitative easing, they were actually doing it in order to provide liquidity to the market. We don't have that problem now with mortgage-backed securities, but the Fed is still using the mortgage-backed security market in order to do its quantitative easing program. But at the same time, you have a mortgage market, a housing market, which is really robust in the United States. And so in terms of the mix of, on the one hand, Treasury bills or any sorts of treasuries, buying those versus, on the other hand, buying mortgage-backed securities, really, you're sending a signal that you're supporting both markets. One market is very hot. The other one, really, maybe this is the one that we should be supporting more. So I think that there's been some talk about that, and it's not clear what the Fed's going to do, when they're going to do it. But at some point, there's the great possibility that any sort of tapering would happen with the mortgage-backed securities market.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. I'm just looking here. I'm smiling because as I'm scrolling through the comments, I've seen one come up that says, I'm starting to think Shiba coin makes more sense than the Fed. Not a good sign.
I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place. I mean, this is one of the reasons that people are turning to fiscal policy, because right. You know, once you reach the zero lower bound, really it's small beer what you can do at the margin, jawboning the market, giving forward guidance, trying to steepen or flatten the yield curve, all these kinds of things. It's really not going to move the needle. That's why we see this massive deficit spending, not just in the United States, but in other countries. And so I think that's where we are. And ultimately, that's one of the reasons that people are worried about inflation. They're worried about inflation because, not because of the Fed, but rather because of fiscal policy. And ultimately, the Fed is there to offset that potentially. That's been their role in the past. The question is this the role that they're going to play in the future? And if not now, when would they shift, if in the future, to the role of the offset to the fiscal stimulus?
Yeah. And one of the many reasons I enjoy doing these shows with you is that you bring it back to the big picture issues. You can bring in and pull in the daily news cycle, but to get the big picture, sometimes it's very easy when we're talking about these kinds of things for people to not be able to see the forest for the trees. But the point that you're making here, I think, is such an important one. This is all about what happens when you're stuck at the zero lower bound. And when you're stuck at the zero lower bound for a very long period of time, other than that one little blip up prior to COVID, we have been here since the great financial crisis by and large. And now we're starting to see some of the risks, some of the instabilities, some of the weird quirks that come in the system when you rely too much for too long on zero rates.
Yeah. And again, you know, bonds, I'm looking at them now, 10-year U.S. 10 years at 149.9. That's relatively low by historical standards. And that is that's telling you that with all the stimulus that we've provided to the market, the bond market's not screaming, we're off to the races. It's quite the opposite. And so it is somewhat of a precarious situation. And it'll be interesting to see how the Fed makes that out. You know, Ash, before we came on, you were talking to me. We were looking at the WTI chart and trying to figure out when was the last time oil was as high as it is today. I mean, that's where the inflation has been, is in energy prices. If you look at crude oil, over, say, the last 5 years, look at a chart, there's only one period in that time that crude has been as high as it is now. And that was in 2018, in June through September of 2018. It got up to $73, $74 a barrel. You have to go all the way back to the shale revolution. Before the shale revolution, but when oil was over this level. So, I mean, these are the highest levels that we've had in crude, pretty much except that brief period in 2018 for a good 7 years, Ash.
Yeah, absolutely spot on in terms of energy. And I would add one other point to that, which is also raw materials. Look at the copper chart. Man, I'm looking right now at COMEX copper prices back to 1971 on the Macro Trends website. All-time high. ATH, as the crypto guys say. $4 and looks like 75 cents. This is going back before I was born.
Yeah, that is amazing. So what are we to make of that? Again, that's the $64,000 question. Whether it's transitory or not, we just don't know at this particular juncture. And then what's the Fed's reaction function to that? Of the three things that I talked about in the beginning in terms of is it transitory or not, we don't know. We're not going to find out after the Fed talks. In terms of the Fed, we will find out more about the reaction function. I'm much more interested in MBS than anything else at this point. And then the third thing is, it does seem like inflation expectations have become subdued. And to me, that's a sign of weakness. It's a you have to go to the politics, to the fiscal policy, to the global policy to understand why it might be that inflation expectations have come down. Because when you look at the ability to get legislation through to continue deficit spending on the fiscal level in the United States at a minimum, it doesn't look as good. And that means less growth, and that's more bullish for bonds. We had the G7 over the weekend, and that didn't seem like it was a huge breakthrough. There was a lot of talk at the margin about getting tough on China. But by and large, there was nothing there from a coordinated perspective that made you think, okay, we're off to the races. They're doing something special. So I think that bond markets are signaling that really we've gotten this lift, this reopening lift, but they need to see more to think that this is something that has legs over the longer term.
Yeah. Ed, we have got a massive backlog of questions building up, so let's jump right in because I'm afraid we're not going to get to answer all of them if we don't get in quickly. Here's one that comes to us once again, Prius Omega, and the question is, if anyone's thinking that inflation is transitory, is the expectation that prices then deflate? If not, and most people are paycheck to paycheck still, isn't transitory inflation still a big problem? So really two questions there from Prius Omega, both of which are topics that you and I have discussed extensively. The first is inflation versus deflation. And the second is, won't transitory inflation still cause real pain in the lives of American workers?
Yeah, so taking the first, I think there are two parts to the first. That is asset price inflation, and then especially debt-backed asset price inflation. And then, non-asset price inflation, so CPI. I think if you have deflation of goods and services, that's one thing. But if you have deflation of asset prices, for instance, we've had a lot of house price inflation, then that's a problematic, especially to the degree that that's a levered asset. So really, deflation could be negative in this scenario, but no one's necessarily saying that you're going to get deflation. It could be that you just have a one-time step change up to a certain level, and then that's it. So it's transitory inflation because it went up, and then it stayed at that level and went up, at the 2% level that the Fed wants it to go up going forward. Where the rubber hits the road in terms of transitory being pernicious is when things happen over the short to medium term that you can't recover from, that really move the needle so far that it really is a shock to the system. House prices going up 30-40%, that could be a shock to the system. Oil going to $100 a barrel, that could be a shock to the system. That could be the thing that tips us over, reduces the amount of discretionary spending that people have. And as a result of that, the economy slows down. So even if it's temporary, even if it's transitory, it could be negative for the economy.
Yeah. Let me follow up with a question of my own on Prius Omega's question, which is, Ed, how do you look at inflation? How do you actually measure it? I mean, if someone's new to this space, they say CPI, PPI, PCE, all these different metrics of inflation. And then in addition to that, we see those numbers decoupling from some broader macro trends, i.e. the spread between core and headline, with energy prices being a substantial driver. And of course, if you look at it in the bigger term picture, you will see obviously these massive spikes in the cost of education and in healthcare. So how do you look at it? How do you measure it on a day-to-day basis? And what do you look for as a bellwether?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I wish I had the answer, especially now when there's so many cross currents that are happening. I mean, yeah. The one thing I can say is that your inflation is different than my inflation. My inflation is different than my mother's inflation. You know, she uses doctors a lot more often, uses the healthcare system more often. So healthcare inflation is more important for her. You know, I have a son who's in school. So education potentially is more important for me. Some people drive, you know, so every individual has a different measure of inflation for them as an individual. But in terms of where we are and thinking about whether or not this is a temporary phase, there are lots of different measures. There's the trim mean inflation. In order to take a look at inflation only here, you can cut out certain things like, you know, food and energy, which are very variable, and look at the core measure. Or you can take all the things that are going up ridiculous amounts and cut them out and see what the underlying trend is. But that's what people are really trying to do. What they're trying to say is, when you take away the things that are fluctuating in ways that are meaningless, the noise, what's the underlying trend underneath? And how long lasting is that trend? And from what I can tell, for the average consumer, the trend is towards more higher prices and an elevation of prices that we haven't seen in quite some time. So definitely over 2% for core and for many other measures. There are one or two, like trimmed mean, I believe, which are benign, but this is why people are worried.
Ed, you know why my inflation is so brutal? Because I'm a New York City bachelor who works like 14 hours a day. So like an incredibly disgusting percentage of my paycheck goes to Seamless Web, to Postmates, to Grubhub, right? Because it's all the food price inflation that we're seeing. And one of the things that we're seeing is, even within food price inflation, I don't have the chart in front of me, but I was reading about this last week, I believe, is that within food price inflation, there is a bifurcation, another drinking term for us. There's this bifurcation between prepared foods, which is basically what I consume, that's restaurants and delivery services, and groceries that are, you know, at what you would see at your local supermarket. So again, your inflation and my inflation, very different. And I'm getting whacked. Zero question.
You know, I'm looking at trimmed mean as you say that. And this is I believe it's a Dallas number or a Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. There's nothing happening there. You know, it's up and down. There's no discernible price signal. So again, we're in unprecedented waters in terms of the pandemic and coming back from it. Nothing that's happening in the data that we've seen so far is giving us a clear indication of what to expect going forward. So it still is very much up in the air as to whether this is for our friend who was talking about the drinking games, it's transitory or not. There's another drink for you there.
What do they do? How do they calculate the trimmed mean? It's basically they take PCE and then they whack it up into quartiles or quintiles, and they slice off the top and bottom and then take a moving average of that trim.
Exactly. I believe that's exactly how it is. It's a proxy for true core PCE inflation.
Right. By the way, I think we literally have the only show rolling right now where people are just like looking at charts, right? We actually just like, I don't know, let's look it up. Okay, so here we go. Here's a question that comes to us from Louis G. My question for the panel: for a younger investor, is there any point in holding bonds in a portfolio? Is the 60-40 portfolio dead, Ed?
You know, I don't think it is. I mean, as we can see, there's massive convexity. You know, the 10-year in the U.S. is still yielding 70 basis points more than the U.K. So you can definitely get some returns there. And then, of course, you know, you have high yield bonds, which are yielding 4%. I wouldn't necessarily call that high yield, but there's certainly some benefit from having that in your portfolio. Interestingly, I would point out that Martin Wolf, he did something on defined benefit and defined contribution plans over at the Financial Times earlier today or on Sunday. And he was talking about UK pension schemes and how overly bond heavy they are and why they've underperformed as a result of that. So that's something to check out if you're interested in that. But to your basic question, I would say, you know, 60-40 is dead, but bonds still have a place in everyone's portfolio.
So let me play devil's advocate here and throw this pitch out to you, and you tell me what you think. So what about the argument that says, look, this inverse relationship between U.S. Equity markets and the bond market is something that has held for decades and decades now, but there's no guarantee that it continues to hold in the future. One time when it broke down, obviously, notably, was in the 1970s with stagflation, that we may be with unconventional monetary policy setting ourselves up potentially, just potentially, for a time where that correlation doesn't hold and you don't get the protection when we're at or near the zero bound, and that rates are just, you know, so low across the curve.
You know, I think when we look within the cycle versus over the cycle or the, over the cycles multiple, it's interesting to look at that because, you know, at a cyclical moment, at the cyclical trough, bonds are doing well where stocks are not. And so there's that offset. But right. Over the multiple cycles, Albert Edwards from SocGen, he will tell you that actually bonds have outperformed stocks. Because we've come down so far from, you know, double-digit levels of interest rates, and that if you held a bond-only portfolio or a 30-year bond portfolio, you would have made out as well and better than if you had held stocks. So they have actually been moving in concert. It's actually, you could say, a causality that, you know, because the discount rates have been coming down, it's given an extra boost to the stock market. And so they've been moving in concert across different business cycles as a result of that.
So again, I'll just do one more devil's advocate question. So that's the analysis. But if you look back on that chart long enough, you look back to whenever we hit that peak around whatever it was, 15, some odd, close to 16%, I think in 1981, and you can watch that ski slope just ride it down basically for that 40-year time frame to the present. I guess the devil's advocate question is, there's no way that we're going to see another 40 years of rate declines of that magnitude because it's simply nowhere to go unless we wind up before, you know.
Well, we'll see once the Chinese get in there with their their central bank digital currency. Maybe they'll use that to have the deeply negative interest rates that people like Ken Rogoff talk about. You know, instead of having, you know, -1% like the Germans have had, they can go to -7 or -10%. So you can therefore benefit. Who knows what these guys will come up with?
I mean, 1,000 basis points below zero, and we're going to be paying for groceries with shotgun shells and Krugerrand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that one thing that people underestimate is the ability for policymakers to try to keep the institutional architecture intact, to, you know, go the extra mile in order to get things done. Just think, 2008, we went to zero lower bound. We did quantitative easing. Then negative interest rates. Now, they're buying corporate debt and potentially, you know, junk bond ETFs. You can go further and further down the slippery slope. You never know what they're going to come up with next.
Yeah, look, I'm kidding clearly on the shells and Krugerrand, but like there is the risk that people start to completely freak out and panic. I mean, look, we've just come out of a crisis where there was no toilet paper on the shelves. You know, what happens to the sort of the animal spirits if you see rates that low, that far below zero? I mean, it's hard to even understand the cost of money.
Well, obviously, this is what people in the crypto markets are all about. I mean, they're all about, escaping fiat money because the specter of taking it the extra mile is so palpable that they'd rather be in crypto as this happens.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the questions that came into us, and I can't find it right now, basically said, hey, can we talk about what's happening in the crypto space? Obviously, Bitcoin's had a pretty good run here, trading at just below 40,000, 39,820. Interesting comments today from Paul Tudor Jones talking about precisely this, inflation hedging, or the reverse of this, price instability, I guess you could say, and talking about basically wanting an allocation that potentially is as high as 5% Bitcoin.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, I'm looking at some charts, and I talked to Raul about this on Friday. You know, this Bitcoin Ether trade, where, you know, over the last 7 days now, Bitcoin has outperformed as a result of what happened after Elon Musk said, actually, no, I'm not so negative on Bitcoin. I mean, that's what precipitated this move. And Ethereum is down 6% over the last 7 days, whereas Bitcoin's up 12.26%. I've been looking at 40,000 as sort of like a level where it looks interesting from a technical perspective, meaning that I think that's the level at which point the negative, the drawdown that we saw from 64, it has now been erased. You know, we went below 32, almost touched 31 twice. The second low was slightly higher than the first low in Bitcoin. And now here we are almost to that level, the 40,000 level. If we can consolidate above that level, I think people will start to say, okay, we had a 40, 45, 50% drawdown, and now we're back in business. I think that's the sort of thing that you need in order to move to the next level, to get some momentum behind the asset class. Yeah. I'm looking at purely from a momentum perspective. I'm not talking in terms of intrinsic value or network effects or anything like that.
Yeah. Let me throw one out to you, because I think this is a really important question, particularly for people who are just starting to get their heads around some of these comments, topics that we're talking about here today. This one comes to us from Harrison Lindsay. As a total newbie, can you quickly explain bullish for bonds? Does that refer to yields or prices?
Yeah, bullish for bonds refers to prices. Bullish is always about the price. And since bond yields and price move in opposite directions, that means prices going up and yields going down.
Yeah, and the reason that prices and yields move in different directions is because you're bidding in the secondary market for existing float of bonds. And so if you're paying more, definitionally is like an accounting identity, it pushes down the yield because you're paying more money and receiving less back in interest payments on a yield to maturity basis. So Ed, with that said, I come to the conclusion here. I can't believe we've blown through like 45 minutes. I thought we'd been on for like 20. This is like, I just looked at the clock. It's extraordinary how fast this has gone by. So I just wanted to get some final thoughts from you, final takeaways from all of these points we've discussed here today.
Yeah, so I think I'm looking at one of the commenters on YouTube, CG, talking about the 10-year coming to 3%. Ultimately, I think that there's a range of outcomes that are so-called Goldilocks outcomes, and then there's a Scylla and Charybdis on both sides. When we get to 1.4% on the 10-year, people start to panic and think that it's a harbinger of a bad economy. When we get to 2% and above, then people start to wonder, is the discount rate already, and remember, that's a low number by historical standards. Is it already so high that it's going to really kill off the highest of high flyers in the risk on space, you know, the Teslas of the world and so forth? So I think that, you know, it's navigating that very narrow channel that says that yields are not too low and they're not too high. The economy is going just well enough without too much inflation. That's only transitory. That's the only channel I think that works, that people are comfortable with. And there are a lot of risks on either side of those equations. So I think that's where we are right now. And part of that is looking to see what the Fed's reaction function is. It's a wait and see right now for the next 2 days. But when the statement comes out on Wednesday, I think we might see a reaction if the Fed actually says something of note. So it'll be interesting to see if they say anything. I don't have a view on if they will, but that's the big day for the week, Wednesday. Let's see what they say.
And you and I will be here to cover it.
We will. And I think that we'll have Hollywood Jack Farley with us as well.
Fantastic. So until then, we leave you sailing between the Scylla and Charybdis.
Definitely.
Ed, thanks for joining us. Thanks for watching, everyone.